This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview an amazing woman in the hospitality industry who shares their stories of their challenges and successes in both work and in life. Today, my guest is Jill Donenfeld, an entrepreneur who slowly turned her enterprising college side hustle into a business over the last 13 years. The business, called Culinistas, sends private chefs to cook healthy meals in your home. Who doesn't want to have that? I sort of want to have that all the time, just have, you know, a packed fridge and someone cooking exactly what I want, or from Jill's list of delicious-sounding recipes that are on the site. Along the way, she traveled, she wrote cookbooks, and she even started a Batarga business, which I think is the craziest escapade that I know about. But before we dive in and we get to talk to Jill, I am really excited about a giveaway that I'm going to make on Speaking Broadly's Instagram next week. It's going to benefit Empower Through Flower, which is an initiative to inspire and encourage young girls across the country to transform their self-doubt into self-love, which is something we talk a lot about on Speaking Broadly. So I'm honored to be part of this program. I'm going to be giving away a 16-piece sous chef kit from Made In, which are beautifully made pots and pans. So I don't know, sous chef, chef, you can, as a chef, you're going to love the pans. So I want you to check out the Empower Through Flower and see all that they're doing for girls, and check out these super cool pans that you can win if you follow on Speaking Broadly next week. Okay, Jill, I'm happy to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here, Dana. Thank you for having me.
So you grew up in a really close-knit family in Ohio, and it seems like you cooked with your mom and your family eat dinner together every night, which is something when I was growing up we also did. I can't say that inspired me in any way except to recognize that I want to have like more people around the table, more conversation, because I think ours was a little quiet. But the family member of yours that I am most fascinated by is your grandmother, Thelma. Because in reading the letter that she wrote to you, for your bat mitzvah, she ends with this really beautiful phrase. And she says that she wants you to become a modern woman of valor. And I was like, that's so beautiful. Tell me about your grandma and how she might have inspired you to be doing what you're doing today. Did you live up to that?
Well, we'll see. It's a process. God, I remember getting that letter for my bat mitzvah and reading it and not understanding what it meant. My mind was not ready to understand those words and really have a sense of what they could possibly mean. But I do think that I have, whether consciously or unconsciously, ended up following in her footsteps.
So tell me about her.
She was a psychologist. She went to Hunter College. And she was, you know, a girl living in New York who had a strong desire to pursue knowledge and curiosity and growth through that. And she was about to marry some Swedish guy, and then my grandpa came to town on a buying trip. He had a women's department store in Dayton, Ohio. And she met him, and she thought, well, how exotic and romantic. And they got married and moved to Ohio. But she always had a practice and saw patients all through my father and my aunts and uncles' childhood. She was always working, and she very much instilled a sense of work ethic and intellect and curiosity in all of her children that I think that my father has passed on to me.
It was just so sweet. It was like that great typewriter type, you know? It like looked like it was on onion skin. There was just something so...
I know, and there's like typos in it, and then she writes things in. Yeah.
And then, you know, she signs her name as just... it was so sweet.
You know, I found that letter when my parents moved from Cincinnati to Boulder, Colorado, and I was, you know, given the task of cleaning out my childhood bedroom, which was extremely traumatizing. and I found that letter in the closet in my bathroom and opened it up and just thought, wow, I mean, who is this woman? I really always had a very close relationship with her.
So you have an incredible work ethic. When we talk about growing this business as your side hustle, I mean, you were at Barnard College and you were doing babysitting, and then you're like, I think I'm going to start cooking for some people. And then you had like four clients.
Well,
right
I would
away.
Say it was and continues to be always approached through a need of the families and the clients. And yeah, I was babysitting when I was going to Barnard, and very, very invested in the culinary industry. Every job that I had besides the looking after the kids was in culinary. It was working for Time Out, writing restaurant reviews, working for Karen Damasco at Kraft, working front of house at the Mermaid Inn, and just really sort of finding anything I possibly could get my hands on that had to do with food, and really actually focused my major, which was urban studies, towards consumption, they say, in academia, but how restaurants were affected by 9/11 and sort of all of that. And one of the families who I was babysitting for asked me, just, you know, very matter-of-factly, do you know where we could get a private chef? And I said, well, you could contact the culinary schools, or you could just hire me to do it. And the mother of the children said, that's what the kids wanted. I said, great. So I started cooking for them once a week, just stocking the fridge, making healthy, delicious food. A lot of recipes coming from Food and Wine, actually.
Love that.
yeah, of course. And then one thing sort of led to another, and there were a few other families that wanted that, and so I started doing it for them.
But it seems like you continued to, you know, cook for people who came your way. I mean, looking at some of the clips, assuming that they're true, you were cooking for like Neil Patrick Harris and the Kardashians.
Yeah.
Truth?
Yes, that was the LA portion of the evolution of the business.
Tell me about that.
Well, I want to back up a little bit.
Sure.
After I was working as a private chef myself in college, when I graduated, I really didn't know what to do. There was one job that I knew about, and that was editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, and that was taken. And I really did not have the imagination of what are the other jobs that I can have that, you know, a Barnard grad could really cut their teeth in. So I thought, well, I'll just make this side hustle into a business. And so, you know, incorporated it and did that stuff and started marketing it. And PR was really my strong suit. I was living in the West Village at the time, and I wrote a letter that I printed out and I put in every single mailbox of every single brownstone.
Oh my goodness.
and started to get clients, started to get a little bit of press, always with the focus on what I could do for the chefs that would help them really maintain a good job and a flexible job in culinary, and really what the clients wanted. So it was really always about, I guess they call it the product now, but for me it's, I'm a tactile, experiential, personal, you know, focused person. So that's kind of just how I think about it. But I never really thought about the engine that could power something bigger. So I ended up sort of weaving through, you know, this boutique, small business version of what the company is today. And that led me to, oh, I'm hearing that people could use this in California. Well, I want to move to California. All right, I'll move to Malibu, get a tiny shack on the beach and expand to California, expand to LA. So I had moments of tremendous growth and atrophy as I sort of just followed the natural progression of intuition and leads.
I'm curious about the atrophy part, because growth is pretty obvious. You're great at PR. You're super persistent. You're super personable. So I get that part.
Go on, Dan. Go on.
But what was the atrophy part? Like, what parts of it shriveled and then you had to, reanimate?
You know, like I said, this, you know, this started from just me doing it, and it sort of radiated out from there. And so I think I'm a pretty organized person. My brain is decently sized. And I would grow it to like 10 chefs and, you know, 20, 25 clients. And there would be this block that I couldn't really get above. And did not want to spend my time thinking about how can I get over the hurdle. It was just sort of...
Is that why? It's like you just... That was not where you wanted to spend your energy. And you sort of accepted it like, this is pretty awesome, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, to your... speaking to your description of me, a very nice description, at the front end of the show, I have pursued very many things, you know? So when I came back from... I lived in Malibu for 2 years and grew the business in LA. And by the way, if you're one person, you move to LA to grow a business, your New York business kind of suffers, right? So I ended up actually coming back to New York. Malibu is not really a place to get work done, by the way. and immediately had an opportunity to work with a hotel in southern India to help them write their cookbook. I had lived in Madagascar. And had ended up writing a cookbook there in 2007.
I so want to know about that, because of all the things that, you know, line up, like Barnard, you know, great idea in your dorm, start a business, grow the business, move to Malibu, like that all makes sense. And then we trip across Madagascar.
Yeah.
And you were there for 5 months and then you ended up writing this cookbook, really niche-y. So I'm just curious, like, what about Madagascar said to you from Ohio, living in New York and Melbourne, I gotta go to Madagascar?
Well, I will tell you. Do you know the game Risk?
I'll be sure.
It's the Not game well. Of world domination?
Yes.
I used to play Risk with my high school friends, and I would hide my armies in Madagascar. So I knew about it. It was on the map for me.
Okay, that's my favorite thing I think I've heard in this container. Okay.
Truth. This is a truth serum container, so you get all the goods. So I knew about it, and it was a French-speaking country.
Can I ask you something? So, because I haven't really played Risk, just knowing that you had troops in Madagascar, like, what do you need to know about Madagascar, having your troops there? Like, do you learn stuff?
No. No, absolutely not. You just learn where it is on the map.
Okay.
And then I knew that it was a French-speaking country from, you know, French, from the culture portion of the French classes. And I loved where it was on the map. You know, it's part of Africa, but it came off of India. And so what could food possibly be like there with these influences of Indian Ocean and African continent? And I was very curious about that. You know, being a girl from Ohio, you don't get a lot of exposure to that. You get the upside, which is eating dinner with your family every night. And I was very lucky to have both mom and dad cook and brothers who are always at the dinner table. But you don't get the ethnic experiences, the sort of more global understanding of what's going on. So I ended up writing this little booklet. It's a book, but it's little. In 2005 when I lived there, and I self-published it in 2007 because, to your point, very small market. But I so sweetly get like $40 royalty checks every quarter.
Okay, that's adorable.
So cute.
Wait, so did you have any fear of giving up? Because you're to go, you know, you had to have stopped something to pick up your life and move.
No, I was very young. I did it as a independent study while I was at Barnard. And that was my thesis for the study, was I'm going to write an ethnographic cookbook. That will be my big project. And I was young enough, I was 20, that I didn't realize how radical that was, to go to Madagascar versus going to, say, Paris. I just did not think about how radical it was. Now I think back on it and I think, wow, that girl was kind of cool.
And so you didn't overthink it. And did you make a lot of plans? You got there and, like, where did you go? And did you have friends? And what was that like? And did you collect recipes
from mamas? I got there and I had a homestay. I guess because I learned from my mom, that was my approach, was going to all different parts of the country, and learning about what food is like at the coast and what food is like in the highlands, to really get a good understanding of the nation as a whole.
Okay, so then when you went to India and the hotel came calling,
yes, exactly. You're like, so fast forward.
I've already been to Madagascar, no problem. Let's just do India.
Exactly. And so that's an example of the atrophy moment where, I'd moved back to New York from Malibu and my business in Malibu was okay. The business in New York was significantly smaller. And I had this opportunity and I thought, if I don't do this, it's going to be sort of annoying later. So I might as well, carpe diem, get on the plane, go do that.
Okay, but I have to believe it's more complex than that, right? Because you have this business that was sort of...
Always running.
And that was a good thing. You invested a lot in it, right?
Of course.
Of yourself and some money. I think you started with $5,000, which I just...
Yeah.
I love that because it's...
That's all I had. It was a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. But... What was it like to put that in hold?
Well, it was always like a hold thing. I never turned it off. I couldn't turn it off, even though I wanted to a lot. I love that it was such a good job for the chefs. I really loved what we were doing for every one of the clients. It just brought such goodness and was such a help to both sides that I never...
So you went to India, but the business kept running.
Yes, exactly. The business was small. The business was boutique. I had my laptop with me, and I was living at the little hotel. And, India is on a very different time zone. So when I was working in the kitchen, learning recipes from their hotel chef and teaching him how to use teaspoons and cups... because of course he's a much better chef than that, can do everything by, smell and taste and sight. Then there would be downtime at night and I would shoot some emails off and make some arrangements.
You ran your business from India.
Yeah.
And how did that feel? Did you feel like this is awesome and you recommended to other people, like, try to do two things at once? Because you're doing two things at once. Like, was that satisfying in some way?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think that... you can be 100% at many things at once. That's so proven with what the business has become now, where I'm so 100% in it. And there is so much more growth and evolution and a larger vision. And we've, created a really beautiful family of our employees and our chefs and our clients. It's maybe it was against my nature initially to dive in wholeheartedly to one thing.
Do you think was fear or just adventure?
I don't think I was disciplined enough. I've always been very curious and always the type of person who would say yes to myriad opportunities. A lot of things really interest me. I like learning. And I don't know that I had the discipline and maybe the confidence to say, I'm going to put forward 100% effort towards one thing and see what that feels like and see what that turns into.
Do you feel you're more disciplined now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have such an inspiring business partner now who has always been, I think, all in on any decision that she makes. And it is really the most admirable thing.
And do you think that she became your role model in this? Like, you watch someone be all in? Because really,
definitely,
all the work that you've done on your own up until you found Tiana Tennant, if I pronounced her last name right, who's your business partner.
Yeah, and, you know, we met in the very beginning of 2017, and we were put in touch through a friend of hers, and now she's become a friend of mine, but she really was a woman I met at a networking dinner. And I had announced at the dinner that I wanted to close my business and I wanted to move back to Malibu and open a restaurant. So if anyone had any information about that, you know, talk to me. And this woman, her name's Rachel Wexler. She's awesome. She just started a company called Black Iris.
What does Black Iris do?
It's beautiful women's clothing.
Okay, just had to ask.
Yeah, check it out. It's nice. But she came up to me after the dinner and she said, I want to put you in touch with my friend Tiana. She's working at JP Morgan now, but she wants to open a restaurant in Amagansett. And so we were put together to talk about our seasonal market restaurant ideas. And we got together and we both said, yeah, a restaurant's a pretty bad idea. Yeah, okay, agree. Yeah, a restaurant in a seasonal market is like horrible. Yeah, okay, cool, I agree. And then she said, you know, but can you tell me a little bit more about your business and what you're doing? And I, you know, talked about it in the way that I talked about it, which was very client-focused and chef-focused and culinary-focused. And she saw the need immediately. I think after working in the finance industry, she, you know, firsthand saw tons of women who were just, you know, tasked with raising a family as well as having very serious and all time-consuming careers. And she believed in it immediately, which was overwhelming.
I want to go back to that moment at that dinner, because you said it was a networking dinner.
Yeah.
So tell me about that, because I'm always interested in how people, you know, find the thing that makes their business work.
Yep.
And lots of people go to networking dinners. Yep. And you asked for the opposite.
Yeah, I know.
And you got, well, whatever, you asked for one thing and got its opposite.
Yeah.
Why do you think it worked out that way? And what was the purpose of that networking dinner? And do you believe in networking dinners?
Well, I was invited to a 6-person dinner at someone's apartment. And I'd been in LA for 3 weeks looking after a friend's dog, and was coming back. I was on the plane coming back. When I landed, I got an email saying, actually, it's 12 people, and actually, it's at Gemma. And I thought, oh, God, this is like a thing. Ugh, I don't know if I have the energy. I just landed. I talked to my mom on the phone, and she said, just go. I said, I really just want to order a pizza. And she was like, don't, Jill, don't do that. Just go. So I got there, and it was super bright women, just really, really brilliant women from all industries. And I was very fortunate to be put in that room because it was all women who I didn't know from just a very different segment of New York City life. And it's funny when you say, you know, the thing that got you to, you know, the moment that was transformative. I knew that girl from a guy I had been in touch with to get him into Soho House, through a woman I had met, through a girl I had met in LA who I met from, you know, someone I knew in New York. Like, it's, you know, the butterfly effect of all of that stuff. You
really
can go
tangled
back forever. Exactly.
What's your lesson, do you feel, from that dinner and from that tangle you just described?
Well, I think that if you are open to listening for opportunities, they present themselves, and that takes an element of courage, because you never really know how something is going to turn out.
But it's funny because you came with a really bold statement.
I did. Yeah, I did. I really, really wanted to be done with it. I wasn't growing anymore from how I was doing things. I wasn't personally growing, and that is depressing to me. And just it just didn't feel like I was moving in any direction. And so I think I was sort of floundering a little bit, and I thought, well, I really liked when I lived in Malibu, so I want to move back there. Well, what are the things I can do there? I guess I could be a waitress at Nobu. I could do that. I have those skills. I've done that before. I don't think my parents will be proud, and I think that I'll be amused with this for 4 months, and then I'll be very bored. So what's the other thing I can do? Oh, I know that there's that one vacant building in Malibu. I could start a restaurant. There was the Granita Space, which is an old Wolfgang Puck restaurant from the 90s. So
I'm curious your parents' role, because you talked about, you know, you called your mom.
Yeah.
Like, do they have universal advice that you're like, I live by that every day?
My parents are very trusting in their children. I think that they worked very hard to empower us to have our own ideas and make our own decisions, and to not take anything too seriously, to experiment with everything. Maybe I should have gotten a little more guidance from my parents, I don't know. I have two brothers, and we are all rather individual from each other and just sort of generally. And I think that that's what happens when you have parents who encourage their children to flourish sort of on their own time and their own terms.
Did you ever test them? Like, did you ever do something crazy?
Oh, my God. I mean...
What's the craziest thing
you
did?
Of course. You want to hear the worst thing I ever did?
Of course I do.
I spit in my mother's face.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. Oh, the shame. She wouldn't let me go to an after cast party for a school play I was in. And that was social suicide, you know? So I really felt it warranted at the time. Oh my God, embarrassing. Truth serum, see?
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that first year in business and the your health scare that, you know, made you think really hard about what you're doing, how much you could give to any business, and how to make everybody thrive. So we'll be back in a minute. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. This is Dana Cowan, and I have with me today Jill Donenfeld from Culinistas. So when the first year you and Tiana worked together, you had a breast cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I met T in January of 2017, and like I said, the attraction was immediate. We are really the sort of yin and yang partnership. I could say, in order for us to have a great product, the chefs need to feel ownership over what they're doing, and they need to have, you know, consistent work, and they need to sort of have the logistics and the communication worked out. And our clients need, you know, reliable chefs and healthy food and really people who understand service. And Tiana, you know, could look back and say, oh, well, we need, you know, we need tech for logistics. Let's think about that. And we need innovative recipes so that we can have a consistent product, but also give chefs, you know, ownership and flexibility. And we need scale for consistency. And that was the partner I needed. So she came in as a co-founder in 2017.
So how hard was that, right? Because you founded it and was called Dish is Dish?
Oh, the very beginning.
What kind of name was that?
Well, someone I had a crush on in high school called me a dish once.
No, they did not.
Like your cute dish? You're such a dish. Yeah. And
I guess you liked that name.
I had a crush on him, you know, and it was high school. It's a big deal. So it was the Dish is Dish, and then switched to the Colonistas a couple years in. And what was it like? I was so flattered and honored that someone as smart as Tiana saw what I was doing and saw what I was delivering, saw how we could do it very differently, and saw how we could build it.
But flattery doesn't always make the best business decisions, right? Because that puts you
that's true. Right, that's true.
In a position of like, oh, I'm so honored you're taking me seriously, which could be like, sure, so take half my company. And you developed this idea and you nurtured it, even though it atrophied a little bit, and you had like a great life simultaneously. But what do you?
Well, I think the key with us is that there is a mutual respect and admiration for what we both bring to the table, which are very different things. Maybe that's
right,
more than flattery is what I mean.
I think the question is, like, so you actually felt, as I'm not sure many founders would. You felt okay saying you're going to bring such a significant thing to this company.
You know what? I thought this is cool and let's try it. Uh-huh. Remember, I really didn't want to be doing it anymore. And I didn't want to think through the things that we've thought through now. I didn't want to do that alone. It wasn't interesting to me. And when she showed interest, I thought this is an interesting, you know, moment, and why not dive in? If I don't go for this, it's going to be out of fear, and I should walk towards the fear and see what it's like.
So talk about walking towards the fear, because we started beginning to talk about the breast cancer diagnosis. So you had met this person, you made a partnership. Yeah. And
and we went through the first year, you know, I mean, we were like newlyweds, right? Not having known each other very well. And the first year of any business, I think, is very intense. For this one, it definitely followed suit, hiring a team and growing structure, which was not something that I had any experience doing, and getting to know, you know, how Tiana works and actually getting to know how I work, which I had never really thought of, but seeing how someone else works, you know, they really hold a mirror to you. So we're really just finding a rhythm, I think, of understanding each other and really getting to utilize one another in the best way possible. And I went to a doctor for sort of a random thing, and on the way out said, oh, by the way, can you do a breast check? I thought I felt a lump on my right boob. And he said, oh yeah, sure. So he did the check and he said, I don't feel anything on your right, but here, feel this little spot on your left. And he, you know, put my hand there. He said, do you feel that? And I said, no. And he said, yeah, it's just like a little thing. I'm just going to, like, order you a mammogram. And, you know, you should just get it. And I thought, okay. And by the way, since Tiana and I became partners, I have health insurance, which is just so awesome.
It's right? Great. It's,
yeah,
that's
not,
a big difference.
Not something, that's a huge difference.
Yeah.
And so I got the mammogram, and the doctor came in and said, you know, there's The lump looks a little weird, but there's also two areas, one on either side, that are just these like little calcified spots. So we want to biopsy them. So then over the next couple of weeks, he did the biopsies, and the lump came back as atypia, but the two calcified areas came back as DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ, and some people call it stage zero. It's a cancer that's contained within your milk ducts, so it has not become an invasive cancer quite yet. And that really threw me. I of course then had genetic testing and found out that I was that I have a mutated BRCA2 gene.
I was wondering whether you had, because I have a BRCA2 gene, which is how. I mean, I didn't know that until after I was diagnosed with cancer.
Course.
But yeah, those darn BRCA2 genes.
I know. And, you know, it becomes very real to you. Wow, I'm 34. I was 33 at the time. 33, and I've got this, you know, cancer on both sides. And it's contained within the ducts. But I hope I have a long life ahead of me. And, you know, that gives cancer a long time to grow and spread and take over. So I, you know, made the decision to have a double mastectomy. And when
was there anyone who didn't support that decision? Because there's a lot of opinions about that.
Well, the fact-finding process of this, which was very intense. I found out I had the DCIS on February 9th, and then my surgery was March 22nd. So it was very, very intense and concentrated. And I spoke to about 7 breast surgeons and about that number of plastic surgeons as well to really understand what it meant to have cancer, have breast cancer. I had never thought about that, of course, you know, in my life before. I think everyone ultimately, after they found out that I carried this mutation, was very supportive of it. And thank God that I did that, because when they did the pathology on all of the tissue that they removed, they found 1 millimeter of invasive cancer. And what they say is if you have less than 2 millimeters of invasive, they say it's not, you know, it's not really necessary to do radiation or chemotherapy. But if you have over 2 millimeters, then they recommend it. So I had my boobs until the last moment before they could kill me.
It's good that your boobs didn't, you know, do you in. Did it make you feel differently about the business you were about to embark on? Like, was this a moment that you had...
Yeah, it felt
sort of
so. It felt so unfair. It felt so unfair. You know, coming into a partnership, you really want to prove to your partner that you know you're in it. You're doing it together. You're focused. You're growing. You're like, you're the team. You know, and Tiana and I really had that, and then this happened, and my attention necessarily needed to be split in order to save my life. And it just felt unfair. It felt like, you know, if I focused on figuring out my health stuff, then I was going to be, you know, failing the business. And if I focused on the business, then I might die. You know, I wouldn't be able to focus on the business for too long, potentially. You know, and it goes back to what we were saying of, I really don't know if I can do two things 100% at the same time. I don't know if anyone can.
And about the business itself, did it make you think, I really want to, when this is cleared up, I want to double down because it shows me something that I'm really excited about? Or it didn't clearly make you say, actually, I'd rather travel. But I'm wondering what the existential thoughts were about life versus work when you had just entered into that partnership. Like, did it create any existential thoughts?
Well, I can tell you that when you have the stress of figuring out how to stay alive, the stress of other things is minimized. And that is a massive blessing. I think that I was able to be very shrewd and focused on the business when I could be, without the noise of the stress that every day of business and the highs and the lows and the, you know, oh, this employee is great and oh, this employee we're having problems with and, you know, look, we're trying to get press in this thing and why isn't this person paying attention to us? All that sort of thing, all that sort of noise, you know, really just became, okay, what can I do today that's going to be good for the business and that's going to push the business forward and that's going to be supportive to Tiana and our team? Because I don't have time for that noise right now. I've got a lot of other noise.
So when you traded out noise, but then you were healed, did you find it possible to continue to eliminate the noise that actually you realized wasn't important or productive?
I practice that every day. You know, not,
how do you do that?
Not perfect. No, I mean, I think when you have an experience like this in which you have to just get yourself into fight mode, that is learning that penetrates you at a cellular level, and I don't think it leaves you.
And you're lucky in that you had some time to, you know, balance your time with Tiana, right? You had figured out a good way to work together.
Yeah.
I'm curious, because that partnership seems so strong, do you have advice for people who are looking for partners? Because I, for one, for example, I'm so on your side, like happy to do all the creative and so never interested in doing the other side. But finding that perfect person, as you did, is there a checklist in your mind?
Well, I think that when you... I think that what having a partner does, what it's done for me, is has forced me to be more self-possessed and dig deeper into... I'm an intuitive person, so dig deeper into my intuitions, because I know that I have the balance of the other side, of the pragmatist.
Tell me about digging deeper into the intuitions. Like, what does that mean, and what do you find down there, and how do you get there?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think you have to trust your gut. You know, that's what intuition is.
But how do you find it? Like, actually, trust your gut is one of I have a whole series of phrases that I hate.
Oh, oops.
No.
I blew it.
No. But I hate it only because I believe it's true. I believe you should trust your gut. But I think that you can only trust it if you can find it. You know, yeah, there's no map to the gut, right?
That's so true.
And you have to, like, pull off all the screens that are blocking it. And so trust your gut is great for people who have access, but I'm always curious, like, how people... You know,
how you get there,
because that I feel like is actually the key to so many people's future.
I agree with you so much, and I just don't know if I have an answer. But so, I don't know. I agree with you that there has not yet been a how-to manual to getting to the gut.
Right? Like, I want the directions.
Yeah.
You know, like a recipe.
But maybe it doesn't work like that. Maybe that's the special stuff, is that, you know, you have to find your own music and nobody can write that for you.
Yeah, they can't write it, but can't they, you know, like, put the recipes are so great. You follow the directions.
I know.
And at the end, you know, you've got something... I know, really delicious. You know, it's true,
but, you know, can I tell you how our recipes work with
sure.
the Colonistas? We really work to empower our chefs to be creative and trade on their own lineage as chefs, and really lean on that. So we do not have measurements or even really cooking techniques. Our recipes look more like a sports bracket. They're really a roadmap. And, you know, it'll start with broccoli, EVOO, salt and pepper, urfa, roast, you know, and then there'll be another bracket of, you know, making a broccoli pesto that's going to go over the roasted broccoli, and it'll say, you know, broccoli, toasted pine nuts, Parmesan, basil, blend, and then it'll say mix. And we haven't said to, you know, blanch the broccoli first, or sort of what embellishments to put on. And we do that so that chefs can follow what their learning has been and what their feeling is around how they want to best make that dish. For us, every time a chef cooks one of our dishes, it's different. It's a different chef. It's a different family whose needs they're considering. Whether it's, you know, is a 10-year-old going to have this broccoli? Or is this going to be something that a mother takes to lunch? And it's a totally unique kitchen. You know, maybe the oven's broken.
So, okay. I think your point, to get back to the gut, you're telling the chefs to trust their gut. And I think you're telling me that I need a bracket system. Which I actually think a bracket system to figure out, like, where you're going is not a, you know, it's not a bad idea. So, at the end of the show, I always ask people to pay it forward. Someone who you admire in the world of hospitality, and why?
Oh, I love that. Well, I could give a shout out to my first job, which was at a coffee shop in Cincinnati, called Coffee Emporium, and it was a little Victorian house at the end of my block that was it still exists. Owned by a couple, Tony and Eileen, and I walked in there one day and talked to Eileen about a job when I was 14. And she, at that point, they didn't have any employees; it was just the two of them. And she, I think, looked at me and thought, "Well, an enterprising girl from the neighborhood, sure, why not?" And gave me my first job. And she and her husband have gone on to build a little coffee empire in Cincinnati. And they have a couple of locations, and they do a big catering business, and they built it from such the tiniest, you know, little acorn that has just become, you know, a massive tree. And my claim to fame there was that I came up with a drink that's called the Orange Julius, like an Orange Julius from the mall, if you can remember back to those days. But it was soy milk, orange juice, and vanilla blended over ice, and it's still on the menu.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. That is wonderful to feel like you made a lasting impression.
Yes, my legacy in Cincinnati lives on.
And your legacy in so many people's kitchens live on as well. Well, I wanted to thank you so much, Jill, for joining me on Speaking Broadly. If people want to find the Colonistas, where should they find them?
Thecolonistas.com or Instagram at thecolonistas.
And you yourself?
Jay Donenfeld is my Insta. If you want to follow, it's like surfing pics.
Your travels are amazing. I realize I didn't ask you about the Botarga. Okay, so bonus extra points. Botarga on your fire escape, like why?
Oh yeah, that was such a random tangent, wasn't it?
It was.
A tangent of life, if you can have those. I met someone who said, oh, I've always wanted to, I really want to make this Botarga business. And I was like, cool, let's do it. And
can
I
tell everybody, like, what Botarga is?
Botarga is salted, dried roe from a gray mullet fish. And you find those fish in the Mediterranean. You also find them in Florida. And so I met this fellow, and he showed me how to make his Tunisian grandmother's Botarga, and we sort of endeavored in this year of making like 100 pounds of Botarga at a time in this like smoked salmon processing facility in Brooklyn. We'd go in there on Friday night after they'd finished, and we would like slack everything out and then process 100 pounds at a time, and we'd like leave totally bleary-eyed and whacked out on Sunday morning, just when like all the Haitians were getting in to start up like the slicing machines. And we ended up selling to Eataly and a few chefs who I really respect and admire, Justin Smiley and Anita Lowe and Paul Liebrandt.
Who just, so those of you who don't know, those are very fancy chefs. So
yeah, it was an honor.
Justin Smiley has Upland, Anita Lowe had Anissa, which she's since closed. She's one of the greatest chefs in the country. And who was the last?
And Paul Liebrand, and who's just a legend in his own right.
A definite legend.
And you know what? After a year of doing the business, I realized that I don't want to be, I really don't want to smell like fish every weekend. So my business partner in that endeavor sort of continued down that road. And I went back to the private chef life.
That's
Dana,
quite...
I still make Botarga. Now I just make it on my fire escape. And I make like 4 pieces at a time. And I just gift to friends. So when I get a new shipment up in from Florida, I will definitely drop some off for you.
That's a great benefit of doing this show. People gift me things like Botarga. Okay, that's such an interesting thing to... give up a piece of your life too. Did it feel like, did it enhance your life at the time?
Oh, it was so fun. I mean, it was so fun to learn how to do this super esoteric thing that I've always been a big flirt with chefs. And the chefs thought it was real cool. So I liked that aspect.
You really enjoy the esoteric. So many people don't. And okay, so... that was just an extra bonus because I had to know about the Botarga, because when I was at Food and Wine, Jill dropped off some Botarga and it was really good. It was a really memorable for me. So this is you can find me at FW Scout on Instagram and Twitter, and you can also find me at Speaking Broadly. And as I said at the beginning of the show, on At Speaking Broadly, there's an awesome, incredible giveaway of a 9-piece set of Made In cookware, and it is to raise awareness for Empower Through Flower. And you can find out more about this great organization that helps girls find their voice and get over self-doubt at empowertheflower.com. So thank you today for my engineer Kevin, and to Nina, who's here as my co-producer, and we'll be back next week. Have a great week. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.